Ever try to get into one of Advertising Week's amazing sessions and suddenly hear that the room is at capacity? Now you can still experience it in real time. Listen to that keynote or panel as a live audio stream in the Advertising Week app, powered by Live365. Advertising Week Radio features sessions, podcast clips, curated music, and more, both during the shows and year-round. Visit aw.live365.com for easy access instructions. Live365, the world's audio.
Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is a longtime genuine friend. We've been all over the world together. Malcolm, I remember a very memorable breakfast we had in Sydney. Years ago, you were home visiting family in New Zealand and sort of somehow stopped by, and you spoke on our stage at Advertising Week in Sydney and many, many other places, very memorably in Tokyo. I'm talking, of course, to Malcolm Poynton. Malcolm is the Global Chief Creative Officer for Chael Worldwide. He took them from literally beyond the perimeter of the radar and put them right in the middle of the bullseye as one of the world's leading creative shops. He's won every award in the business. Malcolm, if we list your awards, we're going to have to make this three parts. So I am thrilled to welcome my old pal Malcolm, correcting perhaps our most egregious longstanding omission here in the Great Minds canon. So welcome, Malcolm.
Matt, I'm excited to be here, and thank you for such a generous introduction. And I must say, it's really a privilege to be part of the Great Minds series and to join you here today. And I know we have spoken about this for a while, so it's good that we're managing to do this.
We have indeed. We had a great reunion at the Groucho a couple of months ago in London.
Yes, exactly. And as you say, it doesn't matter where in the world we are. It's just being able to have those times to connect and really, I guess, they're really inspiring conversations that we seem to be able to find ourselves having across the table, no matter where we are in the world. And that's a blessing.
We always cover a lot of ground. It is a blessing indeed. As we speak, I'm here in New York. Malcolm is in South Korea. I thought, Malcolm, there are so many places to start with you. We're not going to conclude this conversation without talking about the Axis Award for Emerging Talent, just to give you a little preview of what's to come here, Malcolm. But let's start by talking about the life of travel. You spend an awful lot of time on planes, all of us ground to a halt, which I know it affected my psyche profoundly. I imagine it affected yours as well, as someone who's used to getting on a plane. But it comes with a lot of pluses and minuses. So I'd love to start by asking about the life of a true road warrior. Give us some of the pluses, some of the insights, and take us behind the curtain of someone who literally travels the world and spends time in places that are wildly different from where you grew up in New Zealand.
Yeah, well, I think maybe I'll just rewind a little bit to growing up in New Zealand. And I think, interestingly enough, when you grow up in a country, and not just in New Zealand, but I grew up in a quite rural community in New Zealand. And, you know, New Zealand is truly on the edge of the world. And so everything that you learn or hear about of the rest of the world becomes a fascination, because you're here on the edge of the world, right down at the bottom. You're looking out and across, and you're hearing and learning about all these different cultures and places. And I guess also, I have a grandmother who was born in the UK, and she spent most of her time traveling as well. And always in those days, sending postcards and coming back and telling stories about when she, you know, went so far as to live in Russia in the 70s, which was unheard of, traveling through all different parts of Europe and things. And it probably piqued my interest at that start in life. And then I think as things unfolded in terms of my career, having moved from New Zealand briefly to the UK, to Australia, and then back to the UK properly. Being part of M&C Saatchi as a startup, you know, our foundation client was British Airways. And as I started to lead that account, more and more things became about, different parts of the world and travel. And so naturally, this kind of just began to open up different doors. And then as I moved through other agencies, Saatchi & Saatchi, Ogilvy, and Sapient, then more and more the role became global, that meant I travel. So quickly, I think my attitude to travel was one of like, well, getting on a plane is like going to the bus stop and catching a bus. I'm not particularly excited by that part of travel at all. But what I'm really excited about is what's at the other end, the different cultures, the ways in which we live around the world differently, the common themes that connect us, and the things that brands can do to contribute positively to all of these different cultures in different ways. And at the same time, you also get to see how brands can get in the way of what is developing in local markets. But I think it's really, really, I think it's really exciting to get under the skin of these different cultures that make this world such an amazing place. And that's what excites me. And then on the other side, I'm always incredibly excited to get home and spend precious time with my wife and daughter. And I guess what it does is it filters a lot of stuff out and makes a lot of noise in life go away because you're focused on these kind of more intense times, whether you're abroad or at home.
So you've got your own United Nations in your home, New Zealand, of course, your heritage, your wife Australian, your daughter English. And you touched on it lightly, but this is so interesting. So let's go a little bit deeper. Culture doesn't adapt to us. We adapt to culture. That's on the personal and the professional side. Focusing in just on one particular, and I love the way your bio reads when you talk about your passion for that notion of brands and connectivity and doing something that really excites the consumer, engages them, and the kick that you get from making that happen. Talk about the challenge of doing that across cultures and how you have managed to learn to speak in whatever local language, let's put that in quotes, that you're in.
Well, I think a lot of it is something which I think, with Advertising Week being in different parts of the world, you probably appreciate very well, Matt, is that, getting under the skin of those cultures is what lets you understand what matters to that culture. And I think we in the industry just kind of casually refer to this as insights, I guess. But I am a big believer that the most exciting work in our industry does come out of insights. And in fact, I just came out of a conversation yesterday about two cases that we're incredibly proud of that we have done in Asia, where perhaps in other markets, people might not appreciate it to the same extent, but the importance or significance in the local culture is immense. And, in one case, this is tapping the centuries-old culture of bathhouses in South Korea to introduce women to the correct techniques for breast self-examination. Why would you do that? Well, South Korea has the highest incidence of breast cancer in Asia. And part of the reason behind that is that it's just not accepted in society to talk about the female anatomy. And so there is no way of talking about breast self-examination. There is no open conversation about it. But when we look at the insight and working with one of our clients here, Kundal, who are the biggest beauty brand in South Korea, we kind of understood, well, they make scrub gloves that people use at bathhouses. Women in Korea of all ages visit the bathhouse once a week. We don't know of any country in the world who's been able to inculcate into culture breast self-examination on a weekly basis. What we do know is there's been a lot of money spent in advertising terms traditionally to try and explain this to people, or even social media hacks and other things, but they're ephemeral. They don't last. And in this case, because Kundal's the largest beauty brand, their scrub glove is ubiquitous. To print instructions on that and make that the educational program that is throughout all the bathhouses in South Korea makes a difference. And I guess what I'm explaining is the kick that I get out of that as much as today seeing agencies stand on the stage celebrating success of Campaign for Real Beauty that we launched, you know, way back in my time at Ogilvy, is things that can get into culture because they understand people at that level that might be local. In the case that I just explained about Kwindal's Pink Glove breast cancer awareness in South Korea, or global in the case of Dove, which is about broadening the stereotype of beauty to fulfill self-esteem for women.
Just great. And you're touching very lightly on some iconic campaigns, another hallmark of your career. So let's go back, Malcolm. You and I are roughly about the same age. I started work in 86. I think you started, give or take, 85. Take us back to those early days at HKM Rialto. I'm going to guess that was back in your native land. But take us all the way back. And here you are all these later, is now a member of the Board of Trustees at DNAD. We love DNAD. I was very happy to hear that Dara got the new gig. You were winning pencils, you know, quite some time ago. Take us back to the very beginning.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess it was a very different industry in many respects, but also it was a very different part of the world to be in the industry. And in truth, I was studying architecture, so I didn't really know what advertising was. And it was actually a holiday job that got me into it when I was trying to earn money to pay off sports grants from my time representing New Zealand in yachting. And I had a few outstanding sports grants to pay off there. And one thing led to another, and I forgot to go back to finish studying architecture because I guess this became so much fun. And HKM Rialto, it was a small agency, but very successful startup in New Zealand. And I guess, you know, probably under-resourced meant that I had a few opportunities to do things and grow my career faster because you got to do things, make television ads and things like that when you were a lot younger than what probably you do today. And I think at the same time, we had the benefit of introducing Honda cars to New Zealand and disrupting the market in that sense. And I guess I was just like having so much fun, but at the same time being a sponge and soaking everything up. I guess because of what I mentioned earlier with my grandmother and ancestry being British, I was always fascinated with that. The DNAD annual was a big part of, you know, what everyone in the industry looked up to in New Zealand. One of the founders, the M in HKM, Marko Marinkovic, he had just returned from a few years in the UK where he'd worked at Ogilvy, and, you know, he would always have reference points and exciting stories to tell about what was going on in the UK. So I think I really, really revered that kind of work and that level of work and thought, wow, you know, I'd experienced international competition from a sports point of view and thought, wow, maybe I could do this. You know, that sounds like fun. And then when I left HKM, I remember the managing director of the agency, they gifted me a DNAD annual. And the managing director wrote in it, have the last laugh, be the first one in the book. And weirdly enough, that transpired because I guess it motivated and excited me to do exactly that. And so I briefly spent some time in the UK and then ended up working in Australia in what transpired to be a phenomenal startup agency there. I think still today, probably the most successful agency from a creative standpoint in the Australian industry, although it doesn't exist anymore. And then jumped into another iconic Australian agency, the first being OMON, the second one being the Campaign Palace. Got the opportunity to work across Sydney, Melbourne and New Zealand, learned a lot there because their clients were really the biggest brands in Australia. And it was a very, very populist agency. Like everything they did, you know, really touched Australian culture. And then from there, leapt to the UK to be part of the original crew of M&C Saatchi. And so there's a theme there about startup agencies.
And some clients that you've touched on literally decades in between. You did some work for Adidas way back when at the Campaign Palace. And then all these years later, they come back at Chael.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, they're a client in India. They're also a big client of ours at Iris. So yeah, definitely I've done a lot of work with Adidas over the years. And it's funny, I think, you know, once you work on a brand and you reconnect with it and you see it later, it's interesting to see the journey that brand's been on. And it's interesting when you mention that, Matt, isn't it? Just how enduring and how incredible many of these brands are globally that we take for granted. And if I think about Adidas, and to be fair, about Nike, we've just come out of the summer of sport and we've got the Olympic Games going on. Think about the role those brands are playing in the world. Think about all of the movement, all of the exercise, all of the sport, all of the participation, all of the everyday training in the rain, in the heat, in the monsoons, in the freezing ice, in the team sports, in the solo pursuits, in the specialized sports, even down to curling at the Winter Olympics, all of these things. It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, this on this side, this is what I think we kind of don't celebrate enough. A brand that does it right is truly making the world a better place.
Yes, so well said, Malcolm. I was watching over the weekend. It was a big sports weekend with the Wimbledon final, and there was a big golf tournament in Scotland, and I was watching the Euro final with England and Spain. And I was struck by who the big brands are, and in some cases where the brands weren't. And if you watch Wimbledon and the Masters really stand alone in how clean they are. You see almost nothing with both of those. And then you think about the brands that the Masters is, what Augusta National has created with the Masters brand, and what the All England Club has created with the Wimbledon brand. Those are the brands, really, that almost transcend everything else. You're right, though. I think, we do a very poor job as an industry, and I've heard my friend Raja talk about this quite a bit with his CMO hat on and WFA president hat on. The brands do not universally do a great job of advertising for themselves. And the industry, I think, doesn't always advocate for itself. And I will readily admit I've definitely had a little bit of the Kool-Aid here. But when you look at, going back to Paul Polman and Unilever and the work that he did around sustainability, and you look at the companies in my country, in the US, that support the Ad Council so generously over the years, and I know you've done a lot of work there too. Yeah, we got problems. We're probably doing a little too much, selling sugary stuff to kids, and I think some of the pharmaceutical stuff, I have a problem with, but I do think that we do an awful lot of great work, and I think what you said is I'm going to agree with you, I think.
Yeah. And look, I think, to your point, there are brands who serve different roles in society and different purposes. And certainly I'm not going to be in agreement with anyone who's trying to convince me that a tobacco brand does good for the world. Those are more principled conversations around what industries are beneficial to the world and what aren't. But I think in the main, when I refer to the brand type of brands we work with, in terms of like Samsung's technology, enabling people in ways that couldn't be imagined before, particularly whether it's, current cases of things like Impulse, which for the first time takes speech therapy and puts it on the wrist of 100 million people in the world to help them overcome challenges with speech disorders. These things are valuable contributions to society. And I think perhaps to your point, we take for granted that sportswear brands make sportswear. And maybe they take it for granted a bit too much too, that they sell sportswear. And I guess what I would say is to me, probably the poster child for this and for not taking it for granted would be Patagonia. And the fact that Yves Chouinard has built that business around giving back and protecting the wonderful, precious world that we have to enjoy. I think there should be more of that. And I guess, unfortunately, the industry gets caught in this kind of sort of binary conversation around purpose or sales. And I just happen to believe that those things are mutually beneficial and you should not try and divide them. You should try and embrace both.
Yeah, could not agree more. Right, we got a lot of ground to cover, so let's start moving along a little bit. And you touched on it here too, but let's go back. You've been part of some real magical places from the beginning. Take us back to that first landmark, and you mentioned it, M&C Saatchi. Incredible shop. You were there going back to the mid-90s. Go back to those early days and some of those remembrances. You're trying to, get in there and play against the other big boys and girls. It's a big, big move. There's all kinds of dynamics involved with Maurice and Charles. Talk about those early days.
I think for me, I probably didn't realize at the time just how significant that moment was within the UK industry and then later beyond the UK industry. But I think there were a number of things that I think were incredible about that time. That the chutzpah of the brothers and the founders, between Maurice and Charles, Jeremy Sinclair, Bill Muirhead, and David Kershaw. I mean, there was an incredible chutzpah with those five founding partners. And I would say there was an incredible attitude, which I think, was left behind as a legacy at Saatchi & Saatchi at Charlotte Street, which was their kind of attitude and legacy around impossible is, nothing in their eyes, so to speak. And hence being engraved on the steps, nothing's impossible. And that attitude still, you could feel it within them. And at the same time as setting up this agency with Currys and Dixons, British Airways, these are not small pieces of business, and putting it together with kind of sticky tape, because there were certain legal constraints on what the founders could do or couldn't. And then there was some of the day-to-day business leaders, so the creative leaders and James Lowther and Simon Dickets, and then the business leaders and Murray McClellan and James Hurrell. I mean, these. Sorry, Nick Hurrell. These things, apologies, Nick. These were, there was an incredible kind of focus and energy. The professionalism of them was unbelievable, even as the things being put together with sticky tape, to make it work. And then bringing in all the different new talents created this real energy in that place. And it was growing at such an extraordinary pace. We had, well, originally when I joined, we didn't really have proper offices at all. It was sort of started and above a real estate agency and then moved into this temporary office off Marylebone Lane. And this is before you could have kind of work from home time, right? So you had to have an office, but it wasn't really an office, and it was just like people crammed in left, right, and center. And then when we did move into Golden Square, that was full of jackhammers and builders and construction. So it was kind of like very, very disruptive, and desks and whatever everywhere, and ended up being this incredible building. And that was another part of it, is like the intention and the white marble lobby and the grandness of walking into that incredibly John Pawson-esque minimalist environment set a tone intentionally for clients. And then we had WCRS across Golden Square, and I think there were all kind of shenanigans going on. We'd leave the lights on all night to make it look like the company was working 24 hours on pitches and all sorts, just to kind of create a bit of a tension there between what's going on around us with WCRS and others, and get a bit of buzz going about the place. And it really worked, right? And I think we genuinely thought we could take on any piece of business and any pitch and win. And we seemed to be able to. It was just incredible. So I learned a lot from that startup, but also in the observation of just the work ethic and the professionalism of those founders, there was a lot that I would still carry with me today from that.
And you mentioned some of the great people, Maury and Nick, both dear friends, an incredibly talented group of people. And you really did win almost everything. I mean, and your client roster, Sky and Rolls-Royce and NatWest, you mentioned BA, and it all happened pretty fast.
Really fast. I think also something that struck me, which I think back is probably a little bit different today. I think the fact that the company really backed the product. And what I mean by that is whether it was flying to Scotland with Murray to sit across the desk from Fred Goodwin, the CEO of Royal Bank of Scotland and NatWest, which they had acquired, as a kind of probably slightly disheveled, long-haired, creative guy from the other side of the world. But they would back what that creative product was you were taking in the room. Same thing with Sky, launching Sky Digital. Same thing with British Airways. PJ O'Rourke, Johnny Foreigner spot really rattled some of the clients because it was a bit unnerving to be taking a sort of, I guess, a look at some of the foibles of British culture at the time. But to do that, to turn the tide against the Teofen debacle, you know, all the way up to Morris, in that case, having to get involved to stand behind the creative product, is a very different sort of state than what the industry operates in today. I mean, I think we're, as an industry, we've become far more flexible, far more, I guess, compliant is one observation of the industry, but also I think far less audacious.
Yeah, I think you're right. And this was also sort of the waning days of, let's call it, the analog world. And it seems like M&C, in a way, was sort of that last great burst of almost a romance about the business. Not that there isn't still great work, and I know your work with Dove, with Ogilvy, was still to come. So many other great campaigns as well. So we're not saying that there isn't great work being done today, but there was a romance to it. Does that sound like I hit a little nail there, or am I off?
No, I think you're right. And I think, you know, that takes me to think of if Ogilvy's very famous IBM campaign, you know, that ran for so many years, iconic, very iconic campaign that ran all those years. And there was a kind of romance in that it was film. They were little mini films, every single film they made, and they made countless of them. But then I think as things changed, and certainly that was Ogilvy New York, certainly nothing that I had anything to do with other than admire that campaign. Incredible work from some incredible talents and you know, Chris Walls, Steve Hayden, and people like that behind it. But I think things changed. And one of the things definitely Ogilvy London, my time there, because things have become digital. You know, that was probably one of the biggest significant turning points that started with Campaign for Real Beauty as well, is that it was at the beginning of the digital age. And, you know, interestingly enough, looking back, that was the first campaign in the world whose end line was actually a URL. It was campaignforrealbeauty.com. And this campaign was about sparking engagement and discussion online. And we then created the world's first interactive out of home, actually, in New York, where you text responded to vote for whether she was in the different cases, whether one woman it was couched, is she gray or is she gorgeous? You know, the other one, is she fit or is she fat? Is the and you text responded and it gave you a response in real time how many people voted which way. So this was the beginning of a different kind of advertising that wasn't hung entirely on these mini films in, I guess, what you would call the analog age.
So let's take this ball now and really run with it and jump ahead to Sapient, a shop that was fueled by, known by, referenced by technology. Talk about that navigation from the romance and the craziness of getting on a plane to go sit with the RBS NatWest client and pitch him whatever campaign you had cooked up. This is now late 90s, early 2000s, and then jump ahead to Sapient. You've navigated it all, like, you know, riding a surfboard in Hawaii and not falling off, but it's a very different world.
Yeah, but I think actually what you said resonates with me for the fact that I guess one of the things when I look at what's excited me in the industry is always pushing forward and pushing forward, right? And I that goes back to just growing up in New Zealand and always kind of looking, I guess, from that tiny country of seeing where we can go next and what we can do next. And certainly for me, after Campaign for Real Beauty with Dove, you know, there were a lot of challenges, and actually, although lesser known but significant to an equal extent within the UK industry, was the work we did for Cancer Research UK. And I think just because of the structure of legacy agencies and global networks of that ilk, there were some big challenges about getting up to speed with where the consumers were in the way they were living life with this increasing digital connection. And so Sapient became a really interesting opportunity with the thesis of Sapient, the tech consultancy, merging with Nitro, a small kind of boutique agency, coming together, which is what exactly what we're seeing echoed today with Accenture Song, is bringing together, the tech world with the marketing communication world to unlock a bigger possibility. And so not having to deal with that legacy of a traditional analog agency who's transforming itself, like network agencies were, but getting in ahead of that meant that I had a few friends in the industry who sort of bluntly said to me, "I can't believe you're leaving advertising, getting into this, into that tech world." But the reality of that was also very exciting because, on the one hand, we had clients like Unilever, where we were bringing them to consumers in a digital landscape which no one really understood, and also pioneering things such as vending machines for ice creams that kind of took your photo and shared it on Facebook, and at the same time baking into those kind of glitches, which meant on occasion you would be served more than one ice cream from the vending machine because that sparks conversations, and doing all these crazy things to then building what became a significant pillar to turn the Foot Locker business around. And that was something called Sneakerpedia, which just tapped into fandom of sneakers growing at that stage and gave them back the ability to negotiate and build their business with Nike and Adidas and the other big manufacturers, because it gave them insights as to trends around sneakers that the manufacturers didn't have. And the truth of that was, for consumers, it was like, great, this digital world, we can share our sneakers, photograph them, upload them. It became this massive world's biggest repository of sneakers as an archive. But on the other hand, it fueled Foot Locker's business because it changed their distribution strategy, because all of a sudden you could see that kids in Milan were listening to indie music wearing skinny jeans and Converse. Kids in Rome were listening to rap and street music and wearing Nike Tuned. So all of a sudden, you weren't sending the same stock to the same stores. It then also turned into a Striper Academy for their floor sales team to be able to see that the kids wearing skinny jeans and listening to Converse, wearing skinny jeans and Converse were listening to specific genres and types of music and bands, so they knew how to talk to them. Whereas the Striper in Rome would know to talk around different artists and different concerts and different sports players who wore Nike Tuned. So the sales conversion went up and up and up. The sales team retention went up and up. And it became at the earnings call with Wall Street, one of the three strategic pillars to get Foot Locker back on track. And in actual fact, that just came from a digital mindset, and also a mindset that combined tech consulting that understood how technology could fuel a business strategy to grow the business. And it was only because we could bring all of those things together that you could create something like Sneakerpedia. You couldn't do it without all those different kind of expert points of view coming together.
And you touched on it earlier, but let's use that word insights as a bridge between analog, digital, whether you're in those early days of a creative Wild West, as you were early in New Zealand, Australia, then with MNC, or jumping ahead later with Sapient Nitro, leading bleeding edge of technology, but that common thread, Malcolm, insights.
And I think, again, that is one thing that's been interesting in, I guess, how the industry's evolved, hasn't it? Because at that time around Sapient Nitro, there were lots and lots and lots of boutique digital agencies, lots of them. They all got swallowed up in the end, and they got swallowed up for their execution capabilities. But what I guess happened in those early days, the little boutique digital agencies were all about executions and tactics. They didn't really have insights. I would say that what they had is some appreciation or some kind of sense of like, oh, people are doing this on computers, or they're doing this on websites or one thing or another, but they weren't really deeply understanding, I think, what connects brands to consumers. And that's getting under the skin of real human insights in that way, like I just explained with something like Sneakerpedia. But I think there you needed insights that came from different strategic points of view, whether it be marketing communications and brand insight combined with user experience and technology insights. You needed all that to come together. And I think what has happened is that all those boutique agencies got swallowed up into network agencies who do have insights that make brands connect in those meaningful ways. And I guess that's where the game changed.
It sure is.
It's where we've gotten to today.
No, it sure is. So Sapient Nitro, there were a couple of agencies when we look back who really had a moment. You know, we can go back and say Crispin Porter-Bukowski, they had a moment. You know, RGA, you know, when Bob was really at the top of his game and had Nick Law and Barry and, you know, so many other terrific people, they had a moment. Sapient Nitro had a moment.
Yeah. And of course, today, part of Publicis and has retreated back into the specialism of tech consultancy. So I guess it did have a moment, and that moment culminated in selling to Publicis. And now today, as I say, you know, those core strengths of the origins of Sapient being a tech consultancy are a valuable part of what Publicis is today.
Yeah. Yeah. Very different evolution, though. You know, I can't help but think, and I speak also here as a founder of a business, you know, something doesn't stay the same going forward when you become part of a, you know, when you become one cabin on the Queen Mary. It's a little bit different than being your own canoe in the lake.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. Right. And I think, I mean, I would say that we see this happen in a lot of cases, don't we? And I think it's interesting for us at Chael, we have a different view. So Barbarian Group is Barbarian Group. McKinney is McKinney. Iris are Iris. They're all 100% part of Chael, but you know, we choose to celebrate their specialism and keep that specialism for what it is. And we often get asked the question, why isn't everything, it's simpler, just call it all Chael. And well, yeah, that would be simpler, but that would take away, I guess, in many respects, the value and the preciousness of what we acquired in the first place.
Well, you just gave us a perfect segue to talk about Chael. And it's been now close to 10 years.
Yeah.
has it gone by slowly or quickly, Malcolm?
Quickly. I can't believe it when you say it. It's just like, wow. If you said five, I would have said, yeah. It's gone past so quickly. I guess for a number of reasons, I guess everything's moved so quickly in that period of time. I mean, we've grown and evolved in so many ways. And at the same time, you know, I'm going to refer to something that a good friend Ray Inamoto just made an observation about at the weekend. And we actually met a few of us at the weekend in Tokyo when I was visiting and had dinner. Some of us who have crossed paths over the many years at judging different shows. But Ray made an observation that we've just gone through, you know, kind of, if you think about things in longer term calendar events, we've just gone through a 12-year cycle, which of course, from an Asian culture, is a more relevant calendar cycle and event. So we've just been through the 12-year cycle, and it brings us to a new phase and a new wave of what's going on. And I think we think so short term. We think that 10 years is a long time. But actually now I look at it and I kind of think, yeah, well, it's actually a pretty short sprint in the scheme of things. You know, what can you shift and what can you do in a business in 10 years is something that can make a difference. You can make an impact short term, sure, but I think real difference comes at a slightly longer pace. And maybe it is that we just follow the stock market too closely and think everything happens on 24-hour cycles.
Well, live in a world where short-termism dominates, where the tenure of CMOs gets shorter every year, on and on. But let's really dig into Chael here. I don't know the origin story. I'm guessing someone pretty high up in the country you're in right now said, we need to go out and get ourselves our own Harry Kane or LeBron James or Lionel Messi. You choose your sports reference, the All Blacks. Let's choose one that you'll know and love. And they came upon your name. But give us the origin story, how you got to Chael about 10 years ago.
I think at that time, for me, what was interesting is to receive a call from someone at an agency called Chael. And my only reference point was, from the Sapient point of view, seeing Chael turn up unknown at Cannes. And when an inordinate number of Grand Prix and awards for something called Tesco Home Plus shoppable subway poster, naturally at Sapient, we looked at that and said, wow, we should have done that. How did we miss that? How we missed it was because they were so deeply into mobile because of Samsung, understanding how consumers were using mobile and how things could be done differently, that unlocked something which was quite a significant leap in terms of possibilities around solving, you know, traditional shopping methods, etc. So I was really interested because, you know, the next wave, talking about these kind of cycles of things, the next wave beyond things turning digital with desktop and everything was clearly mobile. And that's where the world was going. Social platforms were emerging left, right, and center. You know, people were just starting to consume news constantly on mobile, everything, sport, the whole works. And so for me, it became obvious, a bit like the move from Ogilvy to Sapient was, from Sapient to Chael, that wave of consumer engagement, primarily being through mobile, was the next phase. So that really got my interest. And then I think with that, at the same time, Chael had an ambition to grow and stand on the stage as a global network. And those coming together just was too exciting not to jump in.
So give us a little compare and contrast, if you will, and this is not a gossip show, but it is a vast difference to be working for a WPP, which you have, a company that ends up as part of Publicis, so I know that didn't cross over exactly, but you get the reference, a cowboy startup like MNC, and then to go into a place like Chael, dominated by Samsung, but not your only client, certainly many, many other blue chip brands all over the world, but a very different shift for you.
Yeah. Well, for lots of reasons as well. I think, you know, different cultural traits between all of those companies, you know, even between North American and British companies, cultural traits are very different. I would say actually a couple of things, thinking just back, you know, and made reference to WPP, it's actually quite surprising at a holding company level what influence the CEO of a holding company can have over that entire group. I think in the case of Ogilvy, Shelley Lazarus was, you know, very well able to protect Ogilvy from the greater forces of WPP. I can't comment on that today, but I certainly can comment on the fact that we're seeing holding companies left, right, and center collapse all of and merge all of their agencies to ultimately, I think the end game is the holding company becomes this super agency, doesn't it? And we're seeing that with Publicis ahead of everyone else on that journey at the moment. You know, very, very different, that world of Sapient and that being on the global leadership team and that North American-based tech consultancy, growing, you know, 2 years running, fastest growing tech company in the world. Incredible, incredible focus on that trajectory. Really, really tightly connected team, operating on a very, very high cadence of calls and meetings and so forth, which is very different than, say, the culture of Chael. So going from WPP being a British-based culture, North American culture with Sapient, and then Korean culture with Chael. And I think what's interesting is we're unlike any other network in the industry. The only network born in the 21st century, global network, obviously coming from Asia, have no legacy of those traditional networks that are built out of geographic replication of talent and capability. So every office can does something different, but actually those specialisms can come together when we need to support and do different things. So it's very decentralized in that sense. And that's really interesting and liberating at the same time. We also don't have structurally certain things that other agencies have as part of our capability set because we don't use them all the time. We don't retain them. So what we do is partner much more frequently with different specialists in different places, whether that's through building physical experiences or even at some level producing film. We just do it in a different way. And that is a different mindset and a different culture. It's a culture of resourcefulness and of belief. The belief that we can do what we need to do is incredible.
Would it be fair to say that you have the scale and impact as a global holding company of those in the competitive set that you sit in, but you have a nimbleness more frequently associated with a small boutique?
Yeah, those characteristics of being as agile as a small boutique definitely help define who we are. I mean, the agility at that level is incredible. I think also we don't view ourselves, and interestingly enough, from the outside world, Ken and others don't view us as a holding company at all. We are an independent network. Some of our offices are not called Chael, but we are 100% Chael, and we're independent. So we're able to be nimble in that way. And unlike a holding company that, I guess, forces a whole lot of structure down through all the way to the bottom, that's not how we operate. You know, the markets have the autonomy to grow according to what their market demands are. We're not trying to replicate ourselves everywhere. We're trying to be the best, most valuable partner to our clients in local markets, whether that's partnering Volkswagen in China, Adidas or Samsung in India, or any of the other brands and clients in different markets. It's how we need to do it for them.
Great, great, great stuff. So you work on so many great brands, and observationally, we've seen a tremendous rise of great brands from South Korea in the automotive sector. You know, when Hyundai first launched here years ago, they were a tertiary brand. Today, the vehicles that come out of South Korea are the equal of what comes out of Germany, which is awfully high praise. Samsung, also an incredible story. Give us a little bit of insight into Samsung creativity, how they've navigated technology and really become an incredible force, also in a relatively short period of time. You know, this is an incredible story.
It is an incredible story, isn't it? And I think, again, going back to timeframes, it is an incredible short period of time where brands such as Samsung and Hyundai have emerged to stand on that global stage. And I think driven by audacious ambitions and driven by a belief that it is absolutely possible to do it. But I think in those instances, whilst they're in the industries they're in, there's a genuine belief in doing what they're doing to help make the world better for more people. And whether that's making transportation better and more accessible for more people, or whether that's enabling technologies, primarily mobile technologies, to open up opportunities for more people. These are common things that drive those businesses and I think drives the success. So with that, there's also, I guess, an appreciation and an embrace of partnering. I would say, you know, like we do inside Chael, Samsung don't want to own and build everything. You know, Samsung are very, very happy, if we look just purely for a moment at the mobile paradigm, Samsung are very, very happy to partner with Google on Android and create their own strand. They're very, very happy to partner with Microsoft and with other tech leaders in different fields to make the product as good as it can be. Different to the oftentimes Western approach of like own the whole ecosystem, build the whole ecosystem, control the whole ecosystem. But that comes at a price and a burden. You've got to maintain it. You've got to make it brilliant all the time. It's going to have limitations as to whether it can flex and work for this kind of situation versus that kind. And so the openness of Samsung to collaborate to move things forward is incredible. And on the flip side, the openness of them to share their technology. I mean, most people are still staggered when you kind of point out that the screen on their iPhone is made by Samsung, or when, the chips that are in pretty much every car that we're could reference as a car brand are from Samsung. They're very open the other way as well with technology. And that's different, I think, than a very closed kind of protected world. And it's not to say one is right or one is wrong. They're different. But I do think that that's a big part of what's enabling them to move so quickly and adapt to how the world is going, because they're not going to be caught offside so easily, because they you can change a partnership, you can augment it into something new, you can, kind of park the partnership if you need to as well and move somewhere else.
I love that. All right, so we're going to start to wrap, but I got to go three different places before we say goodbye for now, or as Christoph Waltz said better, a vitase, because it's only so long for now, not goodbye. Tell us about the Axis Award for Emerging Talent.
The world's, I often say, probably most least known award in the industry. But you know what? If I think back to that award, it made the world a difference to ultimately end up with us having this conversation today. Because at that age, I guess coming from that competitive sports world that I had grown up in, I really thrived off, and I probably still do in many ways, thrive off competition. And as a kid in New Zealand, turning up to an award show with, in New Zealand context, the luminaries of the industry, these kind of legends in New Zealand advertising, and to be invited to step on the stage, to be given an award judged by those people, to say this kid has got some talent to go somewhere, keep going, did exactly that. And it's why I feel so passionately about contributing to such amazing programs as the LEA Creative Liaisons mentorship program, which happens virtually and also happens in Las Vegas, and with DNAD, with our New Blood and our Shift programs, because that's where the future of the industry comes from. But I also know firsthand what incredible motivation and inspiration that acknowledgement can make. And to receive it at the right time can set a path and a trajectory in someone which will carry them to wherever. And that's how I would sum up the Axis Award. Little known as it is, that's what it triggered.
It sure did. And what a great, great story that is. So you lead me right to my next and almost final question for today. And we're going to call this part one, Malcolm, because we're going to have to come back and talk about yachting and so much more. But you've been at this a long time. And my observation of you, and whenever we're together, it only gets reinforced. You have such tremendous, almost boyish enthusiasm for what you do. There's not a lot of people who have been at this now 40 some odd years, and you still have that first day at school attitude. Talk about that and what it is that keeps this going for you, keeps it exciting, and keeps your enthusiasm flame on a very high burner.
I think a number of things. One, I mean, I wake up every day believing that because it's a new day, anything new is possible. I mean, I'm not one for looking back much, and this has been an unusual conversation for me because actually many of the things that you've asked, I have to think back because I typically don't look back. And so when I wake up each day thinking, what can we do today that we haven't done before? How can we connect our clients' brands with consumers in ways we haven't done before? Where are things going? I can't help but be excited by that. At the same time, I would say not a week goes by where I'm not learning or discovering something to do with either a shift in how the attitudes of a generation are moving and how the culture is helping move that, whether that's through the intersection of music, sport, or technology into culture. And probably the third thing that contributes to that is all, a week doesn't go by where I'm not amazed at some advancement in technologies that are impacting our daily lives. And thinking about, as much as at the moment, you know, there's been all this hype and overhype and kind of now critique, I suppose, in many people's eyes about AI. But actually, we've been doing things with AI at Chale and getting global acknowledgement for projects we've done with AI since 2017, 2018, before anyone was really talking about it, where we unlocked and preserved the voice of a mother with motor neuron disease so her daughter today in India can still speak to her. That's going back that far. And I kind of look at it with that lens of every day of thinking, well, everyone's talking about what these technologies can do, specifically AI, how it can make the industry more efficient, how it can do this and this and this, and it'll take everyone's jobs. And it's kind of like, yeah, okay, that's one conversation and one question. What can it do for us? The bigger question for us, and certainly what's been driving us in that space, is what can we do with AI that's going to make a difference? And so whether it is preserving the voice of a mother with motor neuron disease, or whether it is actually using AI to decode all languages into syllables that can be translated into haptic feedback to enable people to overcome speech disorders, all the many other things that we've been doing with it, that is super exciting. So when I wake up and think, where are we going today? What can we achieve today? I can't help but smile and kind of feel like, oh my gosh, it's a whole new moment in time. What could be more exciting?
It's like going from one playground to the next for a young kid. Amazing, Malcolm, and so genuine and just really inspirational for me. Let's wrap with a question that is either easy to answer or impossible to answer. You've spent a very good part of your career sort of getting to what's next, right at the beginning or even before it happened. Give us your sense. What's in the Malcolm Poynton crystal ball? What's the next big thing?
That's a great question. And I'm going to give you a very unusual answer because of all these factors. One, I don't think any of us really do have a crystal ball to know. And I think there is a lot of emphasis at the moment around MarTech and a lot of conversation around MarTech. And necessarily so, perhaps because it's changing the industry and how the industry operates. I actually think what's going to come pretty quickly, though, and we're maybe starting to see glimpses of it, is I think there's going to be more emphasis and more understanding on going back to the human qualities and connections of brands to consumers. So I would say there's going to be much more appreciation and understanding that brands are not what perhaps so much people think they are, but brands are more about feelings and what people feel they are. And I think we get caught up and have gotten caught up in a very rational conversation about brands and conversions, looking at performance marketing and optimization. And all those things are really sort of important, small, incremental improvements and optimizations that are going on. But actually the biggest shift, and I think the bigger thing, as the consumers get overwhelmed by an increasing number of ads being thrown at them left, right, and center, is going to be the residual of what do they feel about the brand. And that includes, I think, a shift that we're seeing towards trust in brands. And I think that if brands, I think what we're going to see the shift towards is that consumers who have a feeling of trust towards a brand are going to be much more motivated to engage and buy from that brand. And I think that's going to be quite a big shift that we see, because we're getting all sorts of challenges and issues in the world around trust on every level and every topic. And at the end of the day, what is trust? Trust comes down to how you feel about a brand. And I think so, whilst we've got, and it's not a it's not an either or. I just think that we're establishing and getting to a very established and mature place in terms of what we're doing with marketing technology, that I think the next emphasis and the next shift will be into understanding what it is that's really going to unlock and motivate that consumer trust and that positive feeling in consumers towards brands.
Great. Well, remarkable story. You know, I think you're right. I think, you know, brands that make a difference in people's lives will matter even more. And yeah, as we are bombarded with so many commercial messages from so many places throughout the course of the day as consumer choice, you know, I used to do a little lecturing many, many years ago, and I remember talking about a simple product like mustard. And when yes, when you were a kid, you had one or two brands, and that yeah, was it. That was it.
Yeah.
And now, you know, Lord knows. So
yeah, exactly.
I feel like I'm letting us down, ending our conversation on mustard. But I can't tell you, Malcolm, what a joy this was to talk to you. I hope it wasn't too painful for you. And I'd love to do a part two and talk about yachting.
Yeah, would love to, Matt. Hey, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. And I guess, you know, to being able to get together long distance like this, when we think about it, you know, what an amazing progress that we've seen that enables us to do this sort of conversation. But also, just from the point of view of acknowledging, I think that your passion and enthusiasm for our industry and all things that Advertising Week does to help move the industry forward in ways that make a difference really matters. And so it's a privilege to be part of that conversation. So thank you, Matt.
Well, thank you. And we love having you on stage. I'll get the ever efficient Nadine to get us together for a follow up and see what trouble we can get into in 24 and 25. And I'll see you soon, I hope, pal.
I look forward to it.
Cheers.
Best for now, man. Bye.
Bye-bye.